that by that time bigger issues had arisen in Ceylon. And it was the people, the masses, to the party of development, the party organization, the trade union movement, and I'd reached the stage of fighting imperialism at very much higher levels than the demonstration of wearing a Bible symbol on November 11th.
Had you formed the party and a program by then and came out into the open?
Yes, that happened in 1935 itself.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that stage, the group, the secret group, felt that it had established itself sufficiently in the minds and hearts of people to take the risk of forming an open party, which in those years may have been an invitation to persecution itself.
Mm-hmm. But did you actually find any trouble? Did the authorities give you any trouble?
Not directly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I give you a few details about how the LFSP, once it was formed, conducted itself and did its work,
mm-hmm.
it would help you form some rough estimate of the general social position of the country itself.
Mm-hmm.
You see, up to the coming of the emergence of this radical platform of the youth movement, the Suryamal movement, and now the Lanka Samaj Party.
Mm-hmm.
I think I told you earlier that the interesting political was restricted to a very small layer of the intelligentsia. Now that was largely due to the fact that their politics was operating on the principle of a restricted franchise.
Mm-hmm.
There had been a movement, perhaps the first, I shall say, organized political movement. And when I say the first, I'm having in mind the 1915 riots and all the predecessors of the national movement. The first organized political movement in the sense of whirlwind touring of the country, of public platform, was strangely enough on the most ridiculous issue of opposing the income tax legislation that was proposed by the imperialist government.
When was that?
That was about 1928 or 9.
Mm-hmm.
See? And
why had they to organize a campaign? This would only affect the higher class.
Yeah, they organized a campaign.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I say it was ridiculous. The rich people, particularly the professional classes, whose income was always visible, in professional and trading classes, easily ascertainable, and certainly they were the richest people, who were articulate. They formed organization with the curious name is Liberal League to fight income tax.
Mm-hmm.
And they went about the country. Only harming themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the income tax administration came on the statute book. And in 1931, the universal franchise came.
Yes.
Now,
incidentally, you didn't give evidence before the Donamo Commission?
No.
Why?
Well, I was by that time attached to a school of thought that would have no truck with emissaries from Whitehall.
Were you surprised at the step they took? Because
who took the Donovan Commission?
Mm-hmm.
I have something to tell you about that too. Mm-hmm. It was that commission that introduced the Universal Franchise.
Yes, yes, sir.
Now that you remind me, there is a great omission I must make. Good.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other important trends,
mm-hmm,
which have preceded the coming into existence of the Somerset Party,
mm-hmm,
was the labor movement.
Yes.
Organized by Mr. E. Gunasinghe and a colleague, of his, whoever hit the high spot politically, but whose name deserves mention and perpetuation.
Yes.
Mr. P. Jivendra Singh.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Later he broke away from the thing and, but out of petulance, he tried to form an independent labor party, but then just fitted out. But he was the man who went a long way with it. Of course, he had other people, and at that time, necessarily, professional people always got drawn into these things.
To gain prestige?
Maybe. Well, we should not be unfair. Perhaps in their own right and in their own, to their own conviction. One was Dr. Muttaya.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, Dr. R. Saravanamuttu, of the well-known Saravanamuttu family.
Wasn't there A.P. Tambaya or something?
Not he.
Mm-hmm.
Then, now Gunasinghe, he was one of the earliest politicians he was a man who was jailed with the others in 1915 riots.
Yes.
He was a radical from his earliest days and he was interested from his teenage years in politics.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a member of the various reform leagues and national congress, things like that. And actually, as an individual at least, he represented the radical on the left wing of national politics.
Mm-hmm.
Then he, without encouragement from any other element of the Congress itself and the political bodies to which he belonged,
mm-hmm,
which in those days included even debating societies,
yes,
he began to form trade unions for the first time in Ceylon. He affiliated them to the Second International Labour Party of England.
Labour Party of England.
Mm-hmm. Now, this was the first dynamite introduced into politics in the 20s.
Yes.
And I now recall an answer to one of the earliest questions you asked me as to what originally drew me in my interest in politics.
Mm-hmm.
Was as a schoolboy, it was the tramway strike.
Of 23?
No,
29.
28 or 9.
Right.
Or earlier. When, at that time, the railway running shed was situated in Margara.
I know something about the strike, so.
You see, that was on the opposite side of the road for the air system. That passed through that strip between the railway station and Harstow.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was, at that time, the biggest agglomeration of
workers,
the biggest unit, seen in time, 2,000 or 3,000 people, the railway workshop there. And during the tramway strike, the railway workshop men also were joined in the strike.
Yes.
And Maradona was in the proletarian quarter par excellence.
That's the island of politician of the time.
Probably, yes. And you can refer to Gunasinghe's memoirs on this.
Yes.
I remember as a schoolboy, just after school, but coming from Nungay, the following morning and seeing these various places, I remember going up into a Muslim Guhari or some place and seeing the bullet marks on the wall, with police firing had taken place.
Was Gunasinghe prone to use thuggery at this time?
Now, Gunasinghe, do not forget, when he came up in the Tehringian world, for the first time he brought into focus, even among intellectuals, a class issue, perhaps known by other names. It was not known as a class issue, it was known as merely an upstart trying to give trouble. Then society was such, and that is something I will tell you when I come to the Samaswami itself, which was at that time a docile society, where the traditional ideas of honesty, loyalty, subservience to superiors and to beneficiaries, gratitude and all that kind of mental makeup was the pattern of the Ceylonese mind. And it was quite easy for any of the people whom Gunasinghe opposed. He has just got a hand for people to get whom Gunasinghe beaten up. And one of the first things that Gunasinghe did, or should have done, and must have done, was to organize a personal bodyguard for himself. Quite apart from even the thuggery that the police were prone to practice in those years. There was private thuggery always abroad and afoot. And secondly, once he began organizing the working class, the actual city proletariat, which is all he organized, the urban proletariat, and in the harbor, for instance, it stopped. Now, as we all know, what you start trade unionism or any kind of organizing on the waterfront, anywhere in the world, it is the strong arm that succeeds. Even union rivalry between union, and particularly in view of the fact of the mental makeup of the general population, as long as I referred to, it is only the bold and the strong types that come forward, and that in fact did come forward. So Gunasinghe soon began to be a force once he organized his union. And actually, he did a great job by the people he championed. Of course, he was up against the natural accusation people made that you're doing this for his personal advancement, his personal profit. I have personally read scurrilous pamphlets and cartoons published
by Ceylonese?
By Ceylonese, of course.
So the British also said the same thing.
No, but I've read them in Ceylonese, Ceylonese. He is called collective muttikasi, that the money he used to collect from fellow workers was being misappropriated by him. And he was made out to be a monster of the human race, living on the scanty earnings of the working class. But he did not give two hoots about that. He was a powerful speaker. And with the slightest opportunity he got, even he held meetings at his working places, the organized union, and conducted several successful strikes. And at that time, there was no doubt that at that time the working class was horribly exploited in this country, certainly in the city. That exploitation continued elsewhere, for instance, in the plantations, that is another matter. But in the cities, and apart from day-to-day actions, where he did succeed, and apart from the fact that he was the undisputed leader of the working class, it was unfortunate for him that the legislature of Ceylon was in no position.
What?
In no position, constitutionally, to put on the status quo any working, any legislation beneficial to the working class.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he was the first person who did actually bring into the political arena a new strata of society. And that was before even universal franchise.
Yes.
Now,
did the universal franchise, I asked you a question earlier, did that surprise you? I mean, he was the only fellow who asked
for it. Well, I was going to mention that in case you did not know.
Yes.
There is a story told. I do not know whether it is true. I could not get anything to recall it, either to admit or to repudiate it.
Yes.
But the story is, and it is a fact, that he traveled in the same ship back from England with the commissioners who were coming to Ceylon.
Oh, did he?
Yeah. And the story is told that the commissioners, that they must have made some study of Ceylon before they set out to collect evidence in Ceylon. But the labor member of that commission, what's his name?
Drummondfield,
told him in the ship, tipped him off and said, ask him to ask for universal franchise. And whether that is true or not, the fact remains that he and his delegation was the only body in Ceylon that specifically asked for universal franchise from the commission and the government, and that every other political party objected to it, specifically when the question was put. I have my own idea as to how that took place.
How what took place?
The commission came to the conclusion that they should do the franchise law, and at that stage it was not in existence in Britain itself.
Yes. Oh, it was.
Now that is the point on which I have disagreed with Justice, but he promised to disprove it to me.
Mm-hmm.
I think there were, the women were at 25.
1928, they cut
the university. Is that so? Then I'm wrong. See, but I have that idea.
Yeah, from 1918, it was over 30. From 1918, women over 30. And then 1928, it was women, it was universal.
Anyway, there is this in support of the view I'm now advancing. You see, Whitehall was at that stage having to find some answer to the insistence of the Ceylonese constitutional agitators for further constitutional advances. And they were in the difficult situation of having to make some grant to Ceylon which must react on their policies in other parts of the empire, particularly India, which is a much larger unit. And they would have seen that in Ceylon there was, under the leadership of the professional class, particularly of lawyers, that there was being made almost an unanswerable case for further advance. And they would have themselves realized the class domination there was and the disparities in social levels. And they may have thought, and it is my opinion that they did think so, that the best corrective for the insistence of the class was to mobilize another class.
Mm-hmm. And this is in keeping with good constitutional principles too, wasn't it?
Undoubtedly.
Mm-hmm.
See, and it must be said, for the perhaps unconscious perception of the intelligentsia that was then in political leadership, that they opposed the grant of the extension of the franchise. Anyhow, it was granted. Yeah, and from then on, a new era arose for Ceylon. Now, it might be useful at this stage, before I forget, to say something about the emergence of this, the social emergence, and the historical emergence of this class that had been up to that date in political leadership. Yes. You see, it is customary to date the emergence of national politics to the 1915 incident.
Oh no, it began earlier.
It did. But for convenience people take, because that is the point at which figures and families that are in office, that is in power, appear on the political scene. This must be admitted, that in 1915 saw, for the first time, a common action between leaders and followers.
Yes.
They interact. Not that the leaders took part in the rioting, but the different sets of consequences flowed, but it flowed from the same event.
Mm-hmm.
Except, of course, there is one case of Venus, who was an officer in the town guard.
Yes.
Who was court-martialed for participating directly in the rioting in the Beta, and he was shot.
Yes, and he is supposed to have shot him more, but isn't he?
I do not know. He did participate, because this was held in the court martial and he earned the death penalty. Here, on this point, we have to take cognizance of the general economic situation and the economy of law itself. Ceylon began to be a prosperous place from the time of the plantations only. First it was coffee, and after the coffee blight and wiped out coffee plantations. I think actually they did even survive that, but the emancipation of the slaves in the West Indies,
mm-hmm.
not the knocked Ceylon out of the world's coffee market. Did you know that?
Mm-hmm.
See? And the planters began to think of something new, and the tea which had been introduced into Ceylon in the Royal Botanical Gardens in the late 20s. 1820 began to be planted on a commercial scale, so then tea. And this much you may know, that in 1892 Governor Havelock, abolishing the grain duties, introduced to reimpose the export duties substituted export duties on products. And the economy of Ceylon began to be founded really. I mean, the revenue was, you know, only can be based on the plantation exports. Now, up to that time, the monies that were earned on these plantations were earned entirely by foreigners.
Mm-hmm.
There was a certain amount of primitive accumulation of capital taking place in the professional classes, who were then so large burghers. Almost entirely become constituents in law, in medicine, surveying, and things like those are the three principles.
Mm-hmm.
The trading was a few eminent Indians, then Muslims,
mm-hmm.
and the Muslims had themselves from the latter decades of the last century were even reaching professional positions.
What about some low country singers?
Of course, some of them, many of them. But outside Sierlese and Kingalese, there were the Muslims, more than the Tatars.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of them, you see, reach such high position that in social life, that they began marrying into the communities.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for instance, the Babas. Who are who would be the class in the top drawer of the Dutch burgers. So they retained their name, the original name was Moore.
Mm-hmm.
Baba. Marika Baba. Great habit. And anyhow, with the then a certain pure accident took place where Sambhago was discovered in a particular plot of land belonging to a particular family.
Mm-hmm.
Namely, the widow of one articular who had died. This articular
had been killed.
No. This is the father.
The father.
This widow had three daughters and a son. And they were planned to go under their ancestral home. Very rich way, apparently. And planned to go over something that was booming in the world market. These three daughters of Articular proved to be the, what you might call, the Soong sisters of Ceylon. The Chinese. One married Chiang Kai-shek, one married Sun Yat-sen, one married Dr. who was in the nationalist count of China and who dominated Chinese politics over two or three generations. These three girls, the first married a man called Kotalawala, who was then a station house officer, which was at that time something between the sergeant and the inspector. I think the correct thing now is some inspector.
Mm-hmm.
That post. So after something was discovered, he kept up his job. Well, as I was saying, the eldest daughter married John Kotalawala, who was the father of Sir John Kotalawala and Justin Kotalawala, the author of the book On the Middle Way.
Can I get a bottle first?
Please. The second daughter married Colonel T.G. Jayawardhana, a man who later was Colonel T.G. Jayawardhana. An uncle of J.R. Jayawardhana.
Yes.
And the third daughter married F.R. Senanayake.
That's right.
The other child was a boy who was shot
by
two assassins who in the Supreme Court trial.
They're supposed to have been hired by Kotalawala?
Yes.
Is that correct?
It is quite correct. It is the Supreme Court trial. And it's unnecessary to publish it because it has no longer any political significance.
Mm-hmm.
Except for something to do with modern politics, which I might think necessary to advert to. It was alleged and it was proved in a Supreme Court murder trial that John Kotalawala was the first accused,
mm-hmm.
that he had hired these two assassins, Sinyona and Pila are their names. The Morning Leader actually published in book form proceedings of the trial. And one of those two accused, Signoni or Pila, in the course of the trial turned king's evidence. And John Kotalawala thereafter took poison of some suicide in the remand prison.
Right.
Well, up to that time, I might mention now that you're on the subject, that in the course of that trial, the Jayawardhanas, the entire clan of them, had been in the legal profession. And some of them went out of their way to ensure the proper prosecution of Kotalawala.
Oh, they were against him, but...
Well, naturally, this murder took place over the distribution of the fortunes of the Plumbago itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that there was some participation hostile to Kotalaraja in the legal circles, quite clear on the fact that Kotalaraja got two British barristers from India to defend him in Hasdorf. One was the famous Norton.
Mm-hmm. Who came in 1915?
I don't know whether he came in 15, he came for this trial in the 19-noughts.
But he also came in...
No, oh, that's all. And other was Noble, he had two. And they are developed from that time. A feud against the J.I. Waterman. Long after...
Carried on by?
By the two families of the same actors and Kotalaraja.
Oh, I see.
And if I may jump 40 or 50 years in the narrative,
mm-hmm.
I should say this, that when the United National Party was formed, it was formed of the family connection and adherence and stooges of the Senanayake and the Kotalaraja families.
Why did the Senanayake side with the Kotalaraja?
Well, when those things finished, other economic and political factors had thrown them into leadership.
Mm-hmm.
The Jayawardenas continued to belong to the intelligentsia. With universal franchise, there was mobilized the tenantry of the land.
Mm-hmm.
And the landowners, under whatever label they came, even communists and samasamas, displaced the intelligentsia. That is one of the signal results of universal franchise from the word go itself.
Mm-hmm.
The Jayawardenas...
But in some cases, wasn't it united? I mean, some of the landowners were intelligentsia also.
No, I will deal with that. And it is a matter in which it is of special social significance, even after now, to go into in very great detail, and I propose to do it. But for the purpose of this, for the purpose of narration of this particular
point,
the Jayawardenas always remained in the intellectual world. They never became landowners and estate owners.
Yes, I see.
They were judges, they were advocates, they were not even doctors, they were entirely in the legal profession, as I can recall. Now, J.R. Jayawardena was one of the first secretaries of the National Congress when it was formed. And he, as a man dedicated to politics, at nationalism, a man of outstanding intellectual ability.
Yes.
Joined this national movement and the National Congress. Mr. J.R. Jayawardena had... running down?
No, sir.
Had proved himself to be almost indispensable, as we now see in our day-to-day. In the national movement. But he was always by virtue of being an intellectual leader, in a lieutenancy and under the leadership of unintellectual landowners, constantly suspect.
Why did he join the UNP if there was a rivalry between the families?
He joined the UNP because That was, those were his political principles. And he was a man above personal consideration and family vendetta.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, from his school days, he was a man of outstanding intellectual ability. And in my personal knowledge of him as a political opponent, a man of outstanding political and personal integrity, I would personally put him in the same class as Mr. Philip Gounod, from my personal knowledge.
And though he was your opponent at some stage?
And the matters I gathered while I was his opponent. So anyway, he was subject to whispering campaign throughout the earlier tenure of office of the UNP by a UNP rank and file membership that was composed of stooges of the Sernak and Kutlaula family, who thought, perhaps without instruction from their leaders,
mm-hmm.
that they were furthering the interests of their patrons
mm-hmm.
by undermining Jaja Wagner's position in the party that he had formed. Now, it is of great importance to realize that we in the left knew this all the time. And it was one of the tactics of the entire left movement, and which is even now continuing after it has ceased to be effective,
yes.
to direct its, to make as its target Jaja Wagner, and try to sow dissension and distrust and break up the party of the bourgeoisie.
Mm.
As a matter of fact, it is no longer effective, because since the UNP went out of office in 1956, 56. Since he went out of office in 56, the UNP itself, its composition has been transformed. It is no longer a body, a collection of families, stooges, the Sernak and Kutlaula. Other events have taken place. And actually, J.R. Wagner has come into the enjoyment of his rightful position. I personally think he is the brains of the present government, and that is an anchor. He is he constitutes the mass appeal of this party. Then,
hasn't his campaign had its effect in that he is unpopular in the country? Of some reason, anyway.
Now, popularity in the country is itself something that is based on a number of factors.
Mm-hmm.
Apart from anything else, there are certain personal traits a man must have.
Yeah,
sometimes thoroughly dishonest to be popular. You know, like promising things to everybody, pleasing everybody, kissing the babies, petting men's wives on their backsides, and a number of things. Mr. Jayawardena is a person who stands curiously enough, and perhaps because of his intellectual preoccupation, maybe some people think he is intellectually arrogant on his part. But I think it is his pure intellectual concentration and a reliance on cold logic, which after all, the different men are made up differently.
Mm-hmm.
He gives the impression of being cold. And I think even his mind works like a machine, impersonally. So impersonally that he sometimes, as in fact in an incident I know, completely ignored his personal interests as a matter of principle and lost the 1956 election. I came to know this from him at the time it took place and while I was in the first camp with if you like to know.
Yes, I would.
There was a Jayakodi in his electorate in Kerala. And that's a very important and influential family. He controlled about 5,000 rural votes.
Mm-hmm. Caste vote or?
No, they are tenantry. Mm-hmm. And as late as 1956, the tenantry was susceptible to the influence of its
landlord.
And he wanted this nephew of his made in ADC to the Governor General Solomon, who happened to be my uncle.
Mm-hmm.
And that is perhaps why Jaya was doing the story also.
Mm-hmm.
And if Jaya was in a view, this chap was an NCO or something, thoroughly worthless fellow. And he said, how can I? He was a minister then,
mm-hmm.
who could have got fixed it.
Mm-hmm.
He said, can I ask that disappointment? And look myself in the face. He said, I'm going to lose 5,000 votes. Blow it to 5,000 votes, I'm just not doing it. And he duly lost his election.
Mm-hmm.
See, and I can tell you that there are very few people today in the political world, left, right or center, would have thrown away an election. I mean, a trifle like that. So anyway, the importance of that murder trial and the vendetta between two families against the Jayawardena went on for a number of years, and with the going out of office of the UNP, that has altered the composition of the UNP and I think put paid to that vendetta. To further underline the importance of that vendetta, I might tell you a story. That I was the lobby correspondent for the Daily News for a number of years, from 53 to 58 or so. And I once asked Sir Oliver at Queen's House,
mm-hmm.
What is this? All this time people are saying this, and Jayaja wasn't trying to become Prime Minister. When Sir John was the Prime Minister. And Dudley was against even Sir John while he was a member of the UNP and in Parliament.
Yeah.
And then Oliver gave me a very succinct reply to that question. He said, yes, what is wrong with that? He said, never mind the accusation. What is wrong with wanting to be Prime Minister?
Mm-hmm.
He said, in my opinion, no man should be in politics unless he aspires to become a Prime Minister.
So
was he
saying that he wanted to become Prime Minister?
No.
Mm-hmm.
But he was saying,
mm-hmm.
but that was the popular propaganda against J.R. Even now they are saying that today, when he proceeds to be effective, when J.R. single-handed practically brought the UNP back into office over the years. So anyway, now we were on the
question of trends, eh?
Trends. And the emergence, yes.
Now the insertion.
Yes. No, the emergence of this particular group. Now the, I said that the three articles were the Soong sisters. Because Soong. S-O-O-N-G. In fact, in John Gunther's Inside Asia.
Yes.
In his section on China, he has the heading, The Song of Songs. He is the title for his whole chapter, section on China, you see. Anyhow, that was in the 1935 or 6, one of these critical arts publications. Actually, that's how I take the reference. Boy! Madame, take the packet again. That's also going in. Anyhow, These three families that were now created by this marriage of these three girls all belong to the Goyama community.
Yes.
Which is the numerical majority in Ceylon, the community from which all kings and nobility have been recruited, and the community of agriculturists and farmers who were allegedly described by Knox as the sort of people who only require a bath before they can sit on a throne. Whether this is a compliment to the farmer or it's right on occupants of the throne, matter what to judge. Anyhow, the point is that up to that time, social hegemony amongst the citizens was enjoyed by different castes. Mm-hmm. That is, the caste of the people who occupied in that time provinces, areas, known as the Karagam.